Game On on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Hello, you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until... Whoa, that's a bit loud, isn't it? Or is that all right? It's okay. Maybe I've just been off for so long that it seems louder than it actually is.
You're rusty.
20 years ago, Blackburn Rovers won the Premier League. We'll talk to Chris Sutton and Kevin Gallagher about their memories of that season. Johnny Cooper on the GPA's latest recommendations to curb player burnout and the latest gang-related violence to hit Brazilian football as well. As always, we want your text 51552 or you can tweet at GameOn2FM and we'd love to hear from you before 8 o'clock, as I said. Alan Colley is with me in studio. Did you miss me?
How are you? It's good to see you.
Good to be back.
I didn't recognise you.
A lot's been happening since I've left. I mean, the room looks different. JJ's hair has grown a bit. Robbie's lost a bit of weight.
All the boys look great.
Yeah.
It was actually nice of you to join us tonight.
I've only been gone a week.
It seems a lot longer.
It does, actually. I had a lovely break, I have to say.
Did you?
Yeah, played a bit of golf.
You have the Slazenger tennis ball haircut.
I do. I went in this morning and I said to your wife, she said, what can I do for you? I said, can I have a... Well, just, you know, take a little bit off. Don't make it too short. And I come out looking like a tennis ball.
No, I think it looks well.
Tree-torn tennis ball.
The holiday obviously served you well. You look fit and well and healthy.
I am looking forward to getting stuck back into work. I want to ask you about the Snooker World Championships. I know you're a big fan. Unfortunately, Ken has been knocked out. But he's there on the old commentary duty for the BBC. Who do you fancy this year?
I fancied him, actually. The player who I fancied him before the start of the tournament, Hugh. But the thing that's going against him is he's the reigning champion. And I don't think it's been won back-to-back in a long time. It's a very difficult thing to do.
Selby.
But I fancy Selby big style, yeah.
I fancy Judd Trump.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his.
Very good player. He's actually, yeah.
He reminds me of me. I was just pure talent.
No. Reckless. That's how I would describe Judd Trump.
Goes for everything.
Just goes all out attack.
No safety whatsoever.
Exactly. And that's going to... That might work in the first couple
of rounds. We're here for a good time, not a long time.
Well, sure, yeah.
That's it.
It served you well.
Judd Trump, yeah. We'll keep an eye on it. It's obviously Ronnie O'Sullivan's safety through, with or without his shoes. Mark Williams, he came in saying, my best days are behind me. I think once you say that, once you admit that to yourself and other people, whatever about yourself, you say your best days are behind you, you're gone, you're finished.
I'm surprised he said that because he was having a great season.
He was having a great season.
Having a really good season. He was in great form.
That's a defeatist attitude. Yeah.
And he was playing Matthew Stevens, his mate from Wales. And as you said, that's a defeatist attitude. But I don't think the tournament will get going until the second week, Hugh. The first round matches, there's no real surprises or shocks.
No.
All the favourites are coming through. But when the big boys start playing against each other, the reckless fellas going against
you rack him up, I'll knock him down.
Exactly. But Trump, I'd say you get a good price on Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would actually. Well, yeah, thereabouts. He'd be worth it, actually. Worth a bit of each way value, I think, yeah.
When he came on the scene first, I thought this was the fella who was going to rival Ronnie as the bit of a entertainer, enigmatic kind of a character. But he's never really hit the heights.
Ah, come on. Give him time, for Christ's sake. Well, he's only a couple of years on the senior circuit.
He's around a long time. Judd Trump is around 5 years. Easy.
Is it 5 years?
It would be, yeah. It seems like he's around, yeah, a long time.
Sure, I said there's only yesterday I thought Blackburn were winning that title. Stuart Ripley knocking those balls in on the right hand side. Sure. Bang!
Will I tell you an interesting fact about Stuart Ripley?
Yeah, go on.
Because he was at Sheffield Wednesday when we were there.
Oh, right, okay.
He used to have a hot bat before every match.
Really?
So you come into the dressing room, get your stuff off, there's Ripley panned out in the bath, getting ready for the match.
That's interesting, because you know they say you should never swim before doing any other kind of exercise. That's why triathlons are so hard, because the swimming is the first event of the three. But if you notice, even I used to play a bit of tennis back in the day, never go for a swim before, because your muscles loosen up and you're using different muscles than you're used to. Okay. And actually your coordination just is completely off. So that's...
Well, I'm not sure the reason, but it was he came towards the end of his career. I'd say he was about 34, 35. And I think it was just literally to limber up and loosen up. He used to get into a hot bath, totally kind of soak himself down, relax.
In fairness, you wouldn't do too much swimming in a bath. Not my bath, anyway. You're a bath in the mansion that you live in, but not my bath. He's a solicitor now, by the way.
Who, Ripley?
Yeah.
No way. He was a sound fella, Ripley. Yeah, he was all right.
Yeah, good cross on the ball.
He was. And well, that year now, with Sutton and Shearer.
On a plate.
And who was on the far side?
Wilcox.
And where did I play with him?
Leeds.
Yeah. And Wilcox was sound.
Was he really?
He was a great fella, yeah. I think he's coaching somewhere now, or he's an academy director at one of the big clubs. I was reading about him there recently, but Wilcox was sound.
Two Irish players in that Blackburn squad, name them.
He managed me, one of them.
Jeff
Kenna.
Name the other.
Irish player in the Blackburn squad.
He made no appearances that season, so it's a bit of a tough one.
Yeah, that's hard. No, you have me on that one.
Aston Villa goalkeeper currently flying high in the FA Cup final.
Shea
Given.
Yeah, he was only a kid probably then, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Tim Flowers, obviously number one.
I was going to say, who was the keeper? Flowers, yeah.
Yeah.
They had a great team.
Good back four. Remember Colin Hendry? Tough as nails.
Go through the wall.
That lad and Steve Bruce must have the more broken noses than anybody else has ever played the game.
Yeah, they're no oil paintings, them lads, are they? In fairness, yeah. Hendry and Bruce.
We'll come back to Blackburn a little bit later on, by the way. 51552 for your text. Champions League tonight, looking forward to the Madrid battle.
Oh, I can't wait, Jack. Looking at the games last night, there were probably... Well, I know the Bayern one wasn't over after the first leg, but I still fancied them to win. I didn't think they'd win 6-1.
I wasn't sure. Without Ribery and without Robin, I wasn't sure.
Porto don't travel too well.
It's obviously not. 5 goals in 10 minutes.
No, they got hammered, but Barca looks so strong. I love Barcelona.
Yeah, they do.
They're amazing.
Did you see Iniesta?
Oh, they're just
unbelievable. Did you see what he did?
Just gliding past fellas.
That was like me in my heyday. On a rugby pitch.
And they're great to watch. I think they'll win it.
Really?
Yeah.
I think Bayern, if they get the lads back, I think Bayern look good.
It'll be some final if Bayern. I think that's the final I want. Bayern and Barca.
Let's cross over to the Bernabeu, because tonight's live television match in the Champions League is the Madrid derby, Real Madrid against Atletico. Ronnie Whelan is there for RT Sport. How are you, Ronnie?
Good evening. How's everybody?
Pretty good. What's it like over there?
It's very, very warm. Sun's beating down on this commentary position. Thank God the game's not starting for a little while, because we wouldn't be able to see the players.
Yeah, I suppose the Spanish, though, well, I suppose it's a mixture. It's from Real Madrid's point of view, but most of those players would be used to that heat, wouldn't they?
Yes, yeah, you can imagine. So, there's this thing. It's only when it's extreme heat that footballers have a problem. You know, even when we played in this sort of heat, it wasn't a problem whatsoever.
I was in a Spanish bar last week, even watching the first leg, and it was a feisty affair, to say the least. I'm guessing we can expect more of the same tonight.
Yeah, definitely. It's what Atletico do. It's why they've had a good run against Real Madrid, because they put themselves about. It's not really one of those teams that has one great, great individual like Ronaldo, but they've got a lot of very, very hard-working players, and they make it difficult. You know, they'll put their lives on the line just to get through this.
There seems to be this thing among Real Madrid fans, just reading a few quotes today, that they're worried about this, that they haven't beaten them in 7 games this season. It's going to be a factor. I mean, just thinking back to when you were playing, Ronnie, did you have a team that you just thought, just didn't like playing them, couldn't seem to get on top, couldn't get your best game forward? But did you experience that much?
Yeah, it was only when you come up against the likes of Millwall or Wimbledon, when they waffled a little bit, when they're playing long balls all the time and they just put you under immense pressure. And the big centre forward would try and get all the knockdowns. Them teams you didn't enjoy playing against, you tried to get it on the ground and play football, but they just closed you down continuously. And you did have to be on top of your game to win those games. And I think Real will have to be really on top of their game tonight.
And there's pressure on them as well. I mean, the home crowd, they haven't exactly been as supportive as they could be. That's putting it mildly. You know, they've been on the back of a few players. They haven't been impressed since Christmas. And there's pressure on those players tonight.
A huge pressure. I think they've only won 5 in the last 10 games. You know, and Atletico keep an awful lot of clean sheets. So it's and they're missing Bale and Modric as well, and Benzema. So it's 3 of their major players probably not going to play. So all in all, the whole atmosphere is a bit funny around Real Madrid, because they're not playing great football. The manager's under a lot of pressure now. No team has ever gone on to retain the Champions League. So there's lots going against them.
Yeah, and Atletico, from their point of view, as you said, look, we know what they're about, how they set up that defensive football, which they're very, very good at. But equally, you know, they're going to have to score. I mean, you'd imagine they'll have to score. Obviously, this could go to penalties as well.
Yeah.
But how do you see them setting up today?
I think they'll just set up and make it very hard for Real to break them down. And hopefully, or they will hope that Real get frustrated and start throwing too many men forward and they'll hit them on the break. That's the way I would sort of look at them to do it. I don't think they do much different when they play Real. But you know, when they play them, there's always lots of fouls, there's lots of cards, and it disrupts what Real Madrid do. And 7 games this season, they haven't been able to come out on top, Madrid. So they will be pretty worried. They won't be very, very confident going into this game. They know it's going to be a hard one.
Yeah, and just going through that Real Madrid lineup, I mean, you mentioned no Bale, no Luka Modric, no Benzema. Like, Ancelotti has set himself up 4-3-3 for most of the season. Do you expect him to keep with that, just, you know, replace those players? Or would you like to see him maybe 4-4-2 and change things around a little bit? Try and make a surprise of it.
Well, he's talking in the paper that he's got the best squad in the world. So, you know, he's talking about the likes of Khedira and Ilya Mendy and these people coming in. But when you've got the likes of James and Ronaldo and Toni Kroos and these players, you've always got a chance to win a game because there's something special going to come from somewhere. Chicharito played last week and scored. He probably is maybe going to be the one that will play up front with Ronaldo and maybe James around him. So he's got lots of options in the squad. People are moaning about that he hasn't used his squad properly this year because he's come up with a load of injuries now. But I don't know about that. You know, Atletico last year, they were talking about that. Most of their players played 60-odd games and they got to the within half a minute of winning the Champions League. So I don't put it down to him not making the most of his squad. He's got a lot of good players in that squad, but they're in the quarterfinal of the Champions League, maybe semi-final and the second in the league. So there's not an awful lot going wrong with them. Mm.
How do you see it going then tonight, Donny?
I think Real will sneak it in the end. You know, 7 games is a long time to go, you know, not being able to beat an opponent. And I think they'll probably do it tonight with the home crowd as well, the atmosphere. I think Real will sneak it tonight, 1-0, maybe 2-1.
And just finally, I mean, Bayern Munich, there were a few doubters last night. Those doubters were gone after about 20 minutes. Very impressive performance.
Great performance. I wasn't one of those doubters. Mm. I thought they'd go through, but not in the emphatic way that they did. You know, we only got in off a flight from England into Madrid, and next thing you hear that the 5-0 up after, I don't know, half-time or whatever it was. Without the big players, Robins and the Ribberies and the Schweinsteigers of this world. But I think they just showed that they have the class to go on and win the Champions League. I put it between three, Real, Barcelona and Bayern, as we mostly do every year. One of those three, you would think, will go on and win it. But a brilliant performance to score 6 in a Champions League game.
Yeah, okay, listen, great stuff, Ronnie. Enjoy the game tonight. I hope it gets cooler by kickoff, but thanks many for your time.
Thank you very much. See you soon.
Cheers, Ronnie. Ronnie Whelan there. Didn't exactly narrow it down there. Barcelona, Real Madrid or Bayern Munich.
One of those three will win, will they, Ronnie?
Yeah. I think the Premier League is between Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City and Arsenal.
Really?
Yeah.
One of them will win.
One of those, probably.
Good man,
incidentally,
Ronnie.
By the way, you can get Atletico Madrid at 10-3 to win this match tonight in 90 minutes, but they are just over even money to qualify. So that's on the basis that they think it'll probably go to extra time and maybe even penalties.
Yeah, well, when you look at the stats, the last 7 games, they're unbeaten against them. They've won 4 and drawn 3. You look at the injuries Real Madrid have.
Modric is a massive loss.
10-3 is a big price.
Isn't it?
It really is, yeah. Definitely. Now, in fairness, Madrid, Real were very good in the first game. They probably should have won it. Atletico's keeper played really well and you would fancy them at home, but with Modric, Bale and Benzema missing, and as you said, Modric is a huge player for them and he makes them tick. They're not the same player without him. Just with the stats and especially the mindset Simeone has and the way he sets them up, and they're so kind of resilient and feisty and they fight for every ball. Godin at the back is an excellent player. They work really hard in midfield. Yeah, 130, yeah, I'd take a bit of that.
Okay, we've competition to celebrate betting on the move with the Boyle Sports mobile app. We're giving one lucky listener the chance to win a VIP day out at the Boyle Sports Champion Chase Day. That's at Punchestown next Tuesday, the 28th of April. The winner and a friend treated to 4-star overnight accommodation, a VIP hospitality passes and €500 spending money. So not just that, between now and Friday, we're going to give 5 daily winners 2 tickets each to the Boyle Sports Champion Chase Day at Punchestown. On Friday, we'll put the 20 names into the hat and pick out one lucky winner to upgrade for that VIP hospitality pass, €500 spending money as well. All you have to do to win is identify this Premier League manager. Have a listen.
Play Man United is to play against one of the biggest clubs in the world.
Oh, come on.
Last week, we done a really good one. And then you just go and do that.
I mean, my 2-year-old daughter would guess that.
Play Man United is to play against one of the biggest clubs in the world.
Yeah, slow entries apparently last night. We had to dumb it down a little bit. If you know who that is, text your full name and your answer to 51552 and we'll have tonight's winner, as I said, with those 2 passes before the end of the show. Now, 20 years since Blackburn Rovers were crowned Premier League champions and 2 players from that squad are about to join us. But have a listen first. If you don't exactly remember that season, it was a long time ago, 20 years to be exact. Here's a little reminder of how they did it.
My word, Chris Sutton delivers the first punch and he'll be delighted with that, his 8th goal of the season.
Beresford's header and off Clark. Lucernicic had to come a long way out, could be in trouble now, laid back by Shearer, through by Batty, and it was Peacock who cleared. Now Lasso back into the middle and a goal from Shearer.
sure the champions here. Congratulations to Blackburn Rovers.
Well, the best noise of the day, I think, was the final whistle at Upton Park. It's been a great day for everyone. I mean, Manchester United are concerned, but Liverpool doing them a turn, and they haven't done themselves a turn, so Liverpool's won again, and we won the title, and we're delighted.
Yeah, there you have it, the thoughts of Kenny Dalglish after Blackburn Rovers' final game of the 1995 season, and they were crowned Premier League champions. I'm delighted to welcome a member of the squad from that year, Scotland international as well, Kevin Gallagher, to the show. You're very welcome, Kevin.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, listen back to that. It's 20 years, Kevin, since Blackburn won the title. Does it feel like that?
No, I must admit it doesn't. You know, it's the time, I don't know where it's gone, it's just flown by. It's just unbelievable when you sit back and say 20 years, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I watched every single game of that season, and I was saying to one of the producers, my next door neighbour was a massive Blackburn Rovers fan at the time, so as a result I had to hear day in, day out about how good you were that season. Did you guys, going into the season, have any idea that you had what it takes to win that title?
Well, we gave a good account of ourselves. You know, we newly promoted two seasons before, and there was a plan of attack to sort of do something. But, you know, Alan got a key injury the first season, and then I broke my leg the second season, and we went out, and we, you bring in Chris Sutton, and that was the sort of another piece to a jigsaw that Kenny was building, and the SES was basically born, and that helped us, and we built a team around that, and the success came at the end. But it was, I must admit, it was a lot of nerve-wracking and a lot of wondering, would we ever do it, or was the plan going to schedule? And it, for us, it went 2 years ahead of schedule.
Because you can buy all the players in the world, as we've seen now. I mean, money doesn't necessarily mean titles, but you guys seem to have a sense of camaraderie and a kind of closeness of squad and this self-belief within yourselves. Is that fair to say?
No, definitely. You know, we went out and, you know, I mean, we brought in people like Tony Gale, central defender. He's an experienced, shall we say, probably his last season, in, second last season in football. Young people like Ian Pearce came into the scene as well, so you know, and so we, it was just people that Kenny bought seemed to be the way he'd done it with players. As I always classed it, we were jigsaw pieces. And it put those jigsaw pieces together and we got results. And we weren't a flamboyant side that we had four or five top quality players that were all individuals. We were a team that were built on 11 players working hard together and using our strengths and how we done it, and it worked for us.
And you did seem to work hard for everything, and you know, is it fair to say you were a tough bunch of lads as well?
Oh, it was a great bunch of boys. You know, I mean, you can't take away from them. It's you know, you've got Tim Sherwood, the captain, was, you know, a leader in many different ways. You know, we probably had a team of leaders. We had about seven or eight guys that could have captained that side no problem, so there was no outright captain, but Tim was the one that was the social secretary, that organised everything, that spoke with the manager when the players maybe had a grievance, and that's what happened. And the players all played together, and Kenny was that manner that you had Ray Harford beside him, who everybody spoke to. Ray, he was the gentle giant and respected Kenny, and that's what we played for. We played for that management team.
Well, obviously, someone who was also a key cog in the wheel, if you like, that season was Chris Sutton. Chris, thanks very much for talking to us. What are your memories overall, looking back 20 years ago, since that title was won?
Great pride, as much as anything. You know, 20 years is a long time ago. Look, I came as a young player from Norwich. That was my first season at Blackburn. But I think that throughout the season, we were pushed by Manchester United. But we had a strong team. We weren't the prettiest in terms of some of the football we played. We had two really good wingers in Wilcox and Ripley, and we were effective. And obviously, for me, going to play with Alan Shearer, he was the main man and scored a barrel load of goals, which led us to the title. But Blackburn for me was a traditional family club. And I had five good years there, but obviously the first year, 94-95, was the big one.
Did you feel a lot of pressure? I mean, I remember at the time when you signed from Norwich, it was very high profile, and you were coming in to play alongside the likes of Kevin and Alan into a squad. Did you feel pressure at the time?
Yeah, I think that because as a young player at Norwich, with the great disrespect to Norwich City, we had a good team there. But when you go for big money, as I did, I was still really young as a footballer, and I'd never had criticism before. I could do no wrong at Norwich. You go into Blackburn, big money, people expected to score goals before I'd kicked a ball. Hmm. You know, I was under real scrutiny. But having said all that, you know, you need to step up. I think that, you know, I was helped as soon as I went in. Kenny Dalglish put me at ease. And I went into a team with some real strong characters, more importantly, some good football players. And we had a supply line with the wide men, and you know, the likes of Kevin Gallagher, who was an intelligent footballer, Mike Newell, who I was vying for a place with both of those guys, but obviously for me, a big pull for me was going to play with Alan.
Yeah, and Kevin is on the line obviously here as well with us. And in terms of Kevin, what, you know, someone like Chris coming into the club, and he mentioned there, you know, it could have been difficult for him, but you guys obviously, you rallied around and kind of helped ease that pressure, if you like.
Yeah, I think that was the easy thing about it. You know, I mean, you can talk to people with the new players that come in. It happened to me when I signed in. You met with these guys, the camaraderie got you and you spoke to each other, and it helped you settle into the club. That was about it. And that's what happened with Chris. When Chris came to the club, he was a young player, but you know, I was injured, I had a broken leg. So, you know, you're trying to befriend people and get them to settle as quickly as you can. And thankfully, that worked for Chris.
It was a bit of a strange season for yourself in that way, Kevin. I mean, you came back, obviously, and scored that crucial goal to get the win against Crystal Palace. But as you say, I mean, you're coming back from a broken leg and then you get another one.
I know. It was I mean, all the hard graft and it went through, it goes through your mind when you break your leg, and they then go and spend £5 million on Big Chris, and you think, oh my goodness, where am I going to play? But I managed to get back 10 months later and, you know, take a part of it. What I wanted to do was just be part of that team, and it didn't matter where I played, whether it was up front or on the wing, I just wanted to play alongside it. And when you're watching Sutton and Shearer playing together, it was absolutely phenomenal. So just to be part of one game with them was, for me, was fantastic. And to score a goal in it, that's all I wanted to do that season. And unfortunately, I was back in hospital after about 80 minutes. So it was a bit of a nightmare ending to it.
Why do you think, Chris, yourself and Alan had that such a successful partnership? It doesn't always happen when you have two big signings coming into a club like that, you know, asking a relationship to form. But you guys obviously hit it off.
Yes, we did. But I think, as Kevin will tell you, as a striker, you're reliant on service. You know, I had a good upbringing and a good education at Norwich through the youth team, and I played with some really good players there. So I knew how to play football. I'd scored a lot of goals the previous season at Norwich, so I went into the season full of confidence. But again, it's all about the supply line. Shearer, you know, an absolutely tremendous finisher, strong in the air, had a really low back there for his shot. He hit the ball so hard, and you know, I can't actually really remember him missing a chance that season. And you know, he's proven himself throughout his career. But having said all that, we had strength in depth. When you think of the likes of Kevin Gallagher, we had the likes of Paul Warhurst, David Batty was injured a lot of the season, Mark Atkins came in and did a tremendous job. I just felt, you know, looking back at it now, I felt we were an effective team. We had a lot of strong characters. Our captain, Tim Sherwood, was a strong character. And that took us a long way. And we knew how to win football matches, which I think if you compare it to nowadays, a lot of the way teams play, they don't play to be effective. They play a certain brand. I think that we had nous and know-how how to get over the line and win matches. And I think that's something which a lot of teams miss from today's game.
I remember Tim Sherwood saying recently enough that Mark Atkins was one of the most underrated players in the league that year, for what he did for Blackburn. He obviously, you know, rated him so highly.
Yeah, and Mark was a tremendous finisher. He was a good footballer. He worked particularly hard. I think, you know, Tim was a tremendous player alongside him. As I said, a real strong character. We had characters at the back. Tony Gale came in at the start of the season. who was a good football player. Hendry, Ian Pearce had a big say in the second half of the season, and right the way throughout the team. You know, we had fit, effective, strong players.
Kevin, I mean, you look at the four clubs that have dominated in terms of titles. Well, Manchester United, obviously Chelsea, Manchester City recently, and Arsenal. And Blackburn's win, you know, 20 years ago, it's going to stand tall because it just proves how difficult this league is to win. And for a club like Blackburn, you look at Blackburn Rovers, you look at them now as well, how much they're struggling. It just really puts the achievement into perspective.
Oh, it does, definitely. You know, I can't see really a town team winning the league again for the foreseeable, because the big city teams have the finances, the backings, and you've mentioned three or four of them there. And it just makes it difficult. You know, people with Jack Walker's money nowadays aren't going to succeed in winning the title. You have to have more money than that, as proven at Chelsea, as has been proven at Manchester City.
OK, well, listen, thank you so much for your time. I'm sorry we didn't have more of it, but it's been great looking back 20 years since that title. Chris Sutton, Kevin Gallagher, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
What about Chris Sutton, huh?
Yeah, it's great stuff, you. 20 years, I can't believe it's 20 years, but Sutton was some player.
I remember, I said it earlier to the lads, that next door neighbour of mine, we used to go down and play heads, knees and volleys down the green, you know, and he'd always be, he had the Blackburn jersey on, he'd always be Alan Shearer, you know, I was Dean Saunders. They get up, Shearer, bang, back of the goal. But like, the do you remember Ripley just beating down the wing, crossing the ball in, Shearer get up, bang, goal, Chris Sutton, bang, goal, same.
It was just the old fashioned wingers, I suppose, get to the byline, cross it, and there was the two boys, and as Sutton said there, they used to thrive on that, basically the service. He was putting it down to the service that they were getting. And obviously, Shearer speaks for himself, the amount of goals he got. But as you said, for the two of them to hit it off the way they did, going for such big money, it's not often it always happens like that. And the two of them will be remembered forever, really. And I agree, that was brilliant at the end about Kevin Gallagher, because you can never see the Blackburn thing happening again.
No.
With the way the money's gone now, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and if you have, you know, Walker's kind of money, you just forget about it. Even someone like Mike Ashley, I remember, he was really cool for only having 100 million.
Well, you need about 10 Jack Walkers now.
10 Jack Walkers and 5 Mike Ashleys.
And you might have a chance.
Blackburn were made a president of the league by Man United, who should have won by a hatful the same day, and Liverpool beat Blackburn. And Chris Sutton is an absolute legend. Watch him play for Norwich, Blackburn and Chelsea, my beloved Celtic, says Jane Ulster. Speaking of absolute legends... Give us a hug. Give us a hug.
Oh, thanks, Hugh.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Hi,
to see you.
You too.
Great to have you back.
Hey, Louise,
I know you're back.
You?
I know you're back a few days, but this is the first time we've had a chat.
How are you?
I'm great. As you can see, nothing has changed. Myself and Alan have put on a bit of weight. That's about it.
No, we look fit and well, don't we, Louise?
Well, no, no, you do. You do. You look very well.
How about you?
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm feeling really good. Yeah. I started exercising again on Monday. So I'm sore, but like only from exercise.
Yeah, well, that'll go.
I know, Jesus, though, I'm dying. I'm doing like high impact interval training, HIIT, that stuff. And I'm doing it, trying to do it every day, Monday to Friday, to get in shape for Glastonbury.
Brilliant. It even sounds hard.
It is hard. It's like intense.
Is it kind of weight based?
It's short. So you do it for like half an hour, and you basically do 30 seconds where you go really hard. It could just be running on the spot.
Okay.
You go as hard as you can, as fast as you can for 30 seconds. Then you take a 30 second break.
Okay.
Then you go again. So it's all about raising your heart rate and then lowering it. And apparently it's really good for fat burning and fitness. So.
Brilliant. And the more you do it, the easier you'll find it. So you'll have to keep raising the bar
exactly.
Exactly. Not like the guy on your left there who just likes to keep it at a low base the whole time.
Sure, listen, he's married now.
Easy going to relax.
Why would he's nothing left to try for.
Nothing left in life actually at all. As well as just continue to let yourself go, Alan. You're doing a great job. What's coming up on the show tonight?
Well, Hugh, the show has changed a little bit. So okay. I said this last night, but I'll say it again. We're all about music now. So there's less in my chatter and more tunes, loads of new music. So tonight we've got a new one from Florence and the Machine. We've got a new one from Leanne LaHavis, which is lovely. We've got some really good punk from Slaves, the song's called Cheer Up London. If you're feeling pissed off with your work life, you definitely want to hear this song.
Great.
And then there's also a Dublin band, called Otherkin coming up as well, which is also cool.
I'm looking forward to hearing Florence the Machine because I have my tickets for Electric Picnic and I've never been before.
Have you not?
Never been before.
It's supposed to be brilliant.
Yeah.
It is.
I've been every time.
It's the festival for the old folks, really.
Yeah,
was it?
Correct. No, it is not.
Qualify now.
Yeah.
It's the chilled out festival.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I can't wait.
Yeah,
so
really
listen,
good.
Brilliant. Okay, have a great show. Great to see you.
Good to see you, Louise.
Okay, 51552 for your text. We're back after these.
Game on 2FM.
In
association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
You're very welcome back. Now, the Gaelic Players Association released a report this afternoon that found that half of student county players are often overwhelmed by their commitments. I'm delighted to welcome Dublin footballer Johnny Cooper, of course, who's also heavily involved with DCU, to the show. How are you, Johnny?
No problem at all.
Look, this without going too much into this report, just I wanted to talk to you because of your involvement in the college. And maybe DCU isn't the best example because, you know, the report says that a lot of county players also feel pressurised to represent their college. But actually, DCU might be the opposite of that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think, this, you know, we have a tradition of managing that particular group quite well. Now, it does help, I suppose, that we have been lucky enough to be successful, and that always maybe glosses over some things to an extent as well. So, but in the last number of years, there'll be a good level of experience within the university to, I suppose, manage the guys as best as we can from our end with the types of demands that are on them in, you know, those early part of the year, which is quite high.
Yeah, and there is this increasingly, a lot of players are complaining of the issue of burnout, and, you know, it's obviously something that's cropped up an awful lot in the last couple of years in particular. I mean, would you see guys being pulled left, right and centre just from your time with the college and from your time with Dublin? Is that something that you would see a lot of?
Yeah, that's definitely the case from my own experience of playing here in DCU and being involved and around the setups the last couple of years. That will definitely be the case. You know, we have guys from, you know, as far as Donegal and Mayo and even some guys from Cork and things who'd be expected. You know, it wouldn't be uncommon for guys to be going home sometimes during the week when managers see fit. So it just depends, I suppose, maybe on the manager and the county setup on how, I suppose, how much they're being pulled by the counties and the individual managers and the counties on how they need them. So it depends on the county, if I'm honest with you. From my own experience, obviously Dublin guys are that bit luckier, having be able to train with DCU in DCU and then hopefully, you know, train with Dublin in Dublin as well. So we're probably that bit luckier.
Do you think players feel obligated to play for all those different teams, or is it coaches putting pressure on guys to fulfil fixtures and to fulfil training?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's a bit of a maybe some sort of a legacy type thing where counties of, you know, you don't want to let your county side down, after, you know, with all the friends you go up with or the types of managers that are involved. You coach underage and you want to give them your very best. And then there's probably the same token being shared with the colleges. That's, you know, it's such a, you know, a great experience to play with guys from all around the country. That's, you know, it's an opportunity that, you know, you only get a couple of years at, and the guys are probably put in a difficult position of trying to serve two masters at the same time at certain times of the year, and it always doesn't work out. So it's difficult. It's difficult for the guys to manage, and, you know, I've been in that situation myself. So it's sometimes left upon the player to, you know, to call the shots when it probably shouldn't be. It probably should be other guys making the decision a bit easier for them. So it just, as I said, it is probably dependent on who's involved, what counties, what stage of the year, are they under pressure, certain managers and things. So it just really relies on the person's situation as well.
And there seems to be a lot of anger, Johnny, that there's young guys out there who are expected to act and behave as full-time professional sportsmen when they're not. And this is a period in their lives, 18 to 22, or, you know, give or take a year either side, where they're trying to get an education, they're trying to have a social life, they're trying to develop as people, and also maybe try and earn a few quid to support themselves. And yet they're being asked to give the majority of their time to training and to playing Gaelic games, which doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, it definitely is, and I think that's something that definitely needs to be looked at, or somebody needs to be put in a position to say, you know, to give these guys an opportunity to fully balance what they have in their lives, you know, be it sport, be it education, be it family, friends, you know, all the different key stakeholders that go into making a person perform at their best. And at the moment, we see the balance is probably being outweighed by the sport and the demands, and, you know, you can't go out and you have to train and you have to do everything, you know, and they're not professional sports guys at the end of the day. And, you know, you'd wonder, I suppose, you know, if you ask a question of all the guys involved in the colleges and the clubs and all sorts of teams, you know, are you enjoying your sport? And that's ultimately what it's about. And, you know, you'd have to fear that some of the guys, you know, that wouldn't be a yes answer in all the cases. So I think something needs to be done in terms of balancing, you know, getting these guys to realise that sport isn't the be-all and end-all, and the personal development, in fairness to the GPA, there is a lot of help out there, but, you know, certain guys or certain players might only realise that a couple of years down the road, whereas, in fact, if we can catch these guys early and help them develop that bit earlier, it will set good foundations in place and give them a better opportunity as they progress, touch wood, through their senior teams.
There seems to be a few things that the GAA could do to try and alleviate the pressures on younger guys particularly, and that's, you know, whether you're looking at maybe keeping the underage football too underage and not being allowed to, say, participate in senior training when you're involved in an under 20 setup or whatever. And then, you know, the old calendar fixture list as well, about putting competitions in succession rather than having teams overlap, players overlapping in competitions. There seems to be a few things that the GAA could do that they're not doing to help this.
Yeah, possibly, and I think the calendar, as you mentioned, is probably something that could be looked at. And I think it's probably come to a head here now where something, and i.e. the calendar, is probably the best solution at the moment to, you know, have a good look at it. And there's no reason, I know there's all sorts of dates and, you know, maybe it's commercial issues and maybe it's a couple other things, there's no reason why it wasn't tidied up that bit cleaner, that it would just alleviate those sorts of pressures on guys. And it is only at certain times of the year, but you have to remember that if a guy is playing Sigerson for DCU in January, you know, the start of February, he also has his exams for his university at the end of February, you know, and the exams and his education are going to underpin what he does, you know, for the next 20, 30 years. So you're asking a guy to, you know, play for his college, start the National League come February, you know, asking these guys for all these demands at a particular period of time. And it's just going to come to a pass where, you know, and it probably has in some cases, where guys are putting the sport first and, you know, education second, and you just have to get that balance. And again, the calendar is probably something ideally slot in there, and you could give guys those couple of weeks or couple of months where they can, you know, develop themselves and realise that it's not always about sports and about, you know, being put through the demands that they're already being put on, you know.
Looking back from your own point of view, Johnny, was this something that you struggled with badly? Was there a time when you thought, this is too much for me, I can't do this?
Yeah, that definitely would have been the case. I was extremely lucky. I would have had Jim Gavin as a 21 manager, and then through my time at DCU, and he would have been, you know, as he is now, you know, extremely onside with a guy getting his right personal development, his right balance, his education, his exams, and giving us that necessary space. You know, there was no fear of ever going to Jim and not getting some sort of a time allowance to, if you were under pressure. But, you know, there was stages there, particularly, as I said, in those particular times. You're coming to exams at the end of January with my course and university. You know, you're starting a 21s campaign at the start of February. You know, the Sigerson kicked off. You had a club to weigh in on top of that, certain club competitions and league fixtures and things. So definitely would have went through it. And it's probably, you know, I'm only kind of out of that system a couple of years, and it's probably got unfortunately, probably got that bit worse again in the last year or two, with the way the professionalism of the senior and 21 setups even now is gone.
And it seems like that's, you know, unless something comes from the top, that it is going to get worse. And, you know, you don't want to put all the blame on the coaches either, because you have coaches who are obviously trying to get the best for their team. You have players who are trying to get a balance on their own lifestyle. And it's just, you know, it seems to be going round and round, everybody kind of blaming everybody else. I think, or would it be fair to say, this just needs to come from the top. They need to put in structures that are unbreakable, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, the way the structure at the moment is from the top down, so we all follow that, and there's nothing to suggest or to see otherwise, that if the structure wasn't that bit cleaner and that bit kind of, I suppose, you know, giving guys that opportunity, as we said already, to balance and to give them time off at certain key periods, that if we followed a calendar that just gave us that bit more space as players at certain times, there's no reason why it wouldn't work out. You know, okay, it mightn't fix all the problems, but initially, you know, you might start to see guys, you know, go out and, you know, have those relationships with their friends and their families and the other stuff that they probably is on the long finger at the moment, you know, when you compare it to maybe education, some of them, and sports and a couple other things that they're on top of them at the moment.
Listen, thanks so much, Johnny, for making the time to talk. It's best luck with the final this weekend and obviously for the championship in the summer.
No problem, thank you.
Johnny Cooper there. Great to see him back fit and playing. Just in terms of some of the stats from this GPA report, right, the GPA found that 40% of student county players have had to repeat exams in college. 14% have had to repeat an entire academic year.
It doesn't surprise me in the slightest, Hugh. I'll tell you why. Because these lads, to me it seems madness, because they put so much into the Sigerson Cup. They seem to take it so serious. And in the meantime, they're supposed to be training with their county teams.
Yeah.
Aligned with that, and we all know the commitment that they expect now from county players. It's just phenomenal. So never mind even seeing your family. What chance do they have of ever putting their heads in the books?
And not to mention the club as well.
Club on top of that.
Which they feel obviously a huge obligation to, because that's where they started off.
And some lads are playing probably under 21 and senior because they're so good.
Sure, look, my own cousin, DIT, playing Sigerson Cup, obviously playing for the local club in Skerries, playing with Dublin as well, because he's fortunate enough to be good enough to do it. But I mean, I can tell you, he's dragged everywhere. And then you have to start thinking about your exams, yeah, getting your education, getting a job, socialising, family, friends.
So
women.
Men. Stay away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what do the sacrifice, like, what are they losing out on? So how would you prioritise all them?
Well, you know, this I suppose that's come to light over the last while, that the county teams have a list of things the players are and are not allowed to do.
Yeah, ridiculous.
As in, no drink, you know, no socialising, can't be seen socialising 2 or 3 days before a match, even if they're not drinking.
Yeah.
Like, lists and lists and lists. Then even down to stuff that they have to wear to training, being there, you know, a certain amount of time beforehand, the amount of weights they have to do, the amount of conditioning they have to do. I mean, it literally is a commitment of a full-time sports professional,
yeah,
for an amateur sport.
Yeah, not getting a penny for it.
Not getting anything for it.
No.
And in fact, they're losing out. I mean, look.
Well, whatever about the top boys doing
is
that.
The upside is you get to play for your county. You get to play at the highest level.
Yeah, which all the boys love, I'm sure.
Sure.
Of course they do. But, like, I remember when Jim McInnes was managing Donegal and the reports I was hearing about lads having to take a record of what they were eating for their breakfast and basically email it across to whoever was monitoring that and looking after it. Hmm. At, like, 7 o'clock in the morning, go to a session, go to their work, go to another session that evening. As you said, like, and let's be realistic here. There
guys who are living outside the county and having to drive home for training.
Playing an amateur sport, but training like professionals.
Yeah.
So, and that's why I always feel sorry for the Gaelic lads, because the amount of effort and commitment they put in, but they never seem to get any reward for it.
Well, see, I mean, look, you'd ask the likes of Gooch, or you'd ask the likes of Michael Darren McCauley and these lads who have won at the highest level, is it all worth it? Of course they'll say it is, but
yeah, but they're the boys
who are
winning.
What about the guys who are playing for the Wicklows or the Louths
or Leitrim?
Yeah,
forget about it.
They're being pulled everywhere, and there's nothing at the end of it to show for it.
No, only the pride, as you say, playing with your county. But surely that rubs off after a while as well. If you're getting hammered every year in the championship after training for 6 months, 8 months, and you're getting hammered.
And then the career's over, and then they say, oh, well, hang on, I'm after sacrificing all this time and I haven't concentrated on my career, and, you know, what have I got now?
Yeah, I don't know. But memories. Definitely, them stats don't surprise me in the slightest, Hugh, because, as I said, whatever about even seeing your family, like, their studies must suffer.
If you want to see the full list of the GPA findings in the report today, go onto the RT Sport website and it's up there. There are also some recommendations in the report to address the concerns and the pressures faced by student county players. They're quite detailed as well, so go in and have a look at them, including some of them that I was mentioning to Johnny Cooper there. Anyway, stay with us. We're talking violence and football in Brazil with our man Pat Fitzgerald after the break.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Congratulations to our competition winners tonight, who get those two tickets each to the Boyle Sports Champion Chase Day at Punchestown on Tuesday, 28th of April. I'll be there myself. Should be a cracking day. Robbie Martin, Karen Bennett, Brian Dermody and Shane Prendergast, along with John Curran. So John Curran, Shane Prendergast, Brian Dermody, Karen Bennett and Robbie Martin, you all have two tickets each to next Tuesday. One of you, plus the winners from the other nights this week, will go into the VIP draw on Friday. Best of luck to that, and thanks for entering. Text as well. Fred Taylor says, Hugh, this is a confusing one. Hugh, did you know that Kevin Gallagher's granddad played for Ireland? He was from Donegal. Fred Taylor. I wonder, was that Fred Taylor who texted in, or was that his name? We're not sure. But his grandfather played for Ireland from Donegal.
I'd say that was Fred that texted in, but really interesting. Yeah, never knew that. Obviously, Kevin Gallagher played for Scotland, but maybe we could have nabbed him and we didn't even know about it.
Yeah.
But back I suppose
he was the Jack Grealish of back then.
Back then it would have been probably when Kevin Gallagher was playing, Jack Charlton, I suppose, was in charge. and which he was really good at the Granny Rule.
Yeah,
probably the best of them.
Eleven of them, 10 of them, and Roy Keane.
He was the best Granny Rule manager in the world.
10 Granny Rulers and a Cork man. How are you?
But yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, Kevin Gallagher.
We're going to move on because time is against us. Last weekend, 8 Corinthian fans were shot dead on the eve of their championship semi-final clash with rivals Palmeiras. Pat Fitzgerald is in Rio, and he joins us again on the show. How are you, Pat?
Good evening from rainy Rio, Hugh. Good
well, it's sunny Ireland up here. I won't make you feel too jealous because, you know, one day of rain in Brazil a year isn't a lot to put up with, Pat.
We'll handle it. We will handle it for sure.
Listen, can you tell us what happened with the shooting dead of 8 Corinthian fans? Pretty horrific stuff last weekend.
Yeah, basically this tragedy happened close to midnight on Saturday night when 3 gunmen burst into the supporters club of the Pavilion 9. Supported a group of Corinthians football club and executed 8 of their fans, which makes it all the more poignant. Was they were actually in the process of making flags and banners for the following day's massive derby semi-final against Palmeiras. Initially, like most people would think, that this was a football murder, but police have come out in the last couple of days and ruled out football rivalry as a cause of the murder. It's actually a drugs rivalry that has caused this, and they've identified 3 definite suspects of a drugs gang that operates inside and outside of San Paulo's prisons, which is again quite ironic, as Pavilion 9 was set up in solidarity with the prisoners of San Paulo's biggest prison. Hmm. When Brazil's biggest massacre occurred back in 1992, 111 people were dead, and it resulted in a 632-year prison sentence for the police chief in charge. But overall, this is a terrible tragedy. It got worse for Corinthians on Sunday when they actually lost the semi-final on penalties. And it's a terrible tragedy for Corinthians. It's a terrible tragedy for Brazilian football. And again, for the families of the victims.
Now listen, you've been to a lot of matches over the last year in Brazil. I mean, you were at Vasco and Flamengo, were you, last weekend as well on Sunday?
I was at Vasco and Flamengo, and while you have the figures, for instance, like over the last 25 years, 234 people have died in football-related deaths.
Wow.
And you have isolated incidents like last year where a guy was killed when a toilet was thrown from one section of fans into the other. Going to football in Brazil is actually not that dangerous an experience. It's become far more family-orientated, and I go to a lot of games. I've been to all the big Rio derbies, with 60,000-70,000 people at them, and fans aren't even segregated beforehand. Fans mingle, there's the usual banter, there's the usual handbags. Mm. But I have to say, in my experience, despite isolated incidents like this, which do always get linked to football, whether it's actually the root cause or not, going to football here is an amazingly passionate experience. The atmosphere is second to nothing I've ever seen in my life, and a lot of it is blown out of proportion. I've been to the Maracanã, as I said, to many, many games, and I've been to San Januario to watch Vasco. And apart from one or two little handbags incidents, I've never seen anything which would deter me from going back.
What about the build-up towards the Olympic Games and kind of developments and preparations? We're just over a year out now, Pat. I mean, how are things progressing over there?
Things are progressing with... I guess they're picking up pace and things are getting done. But I mean, last week, there's always problems here. Last week you had Guanabara Bay where a lot of the water sports events such as the sailing are going to happen. Hmm. And there was a major pollution event there where thousands of fish floated to the surface. And then on top of that, you've got the ongoing problems where communities are being uprooted, people are being evicted from their homes, and communities are just being flattened by the mayor and the Olympic developers to facilitate building of buildings and stadiums and security cordons, etc., for the Olympic events. So again, it's building up slowly towards being a repeat of the World Cup protests. I can envision a lot of protests happening down the line, and indeed lots of them are happening already, but they're not getting reported.
That's pretty a damning indictment, though, isn't it, the way the local people are being treated just to facilitate an event like the Olympics. I know it's a huge sporting occasion, but you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that all these local people would be put out so badly to facilitate a sporting event. It seems crazy.
Well, it is crazy to us, and a lot of the stuff that happens in Brazil is crazy to me even after living here for a while. But here it's it's part of the culture. It's been part of the history of Brazil, whereby the few discommode the many. I mean, that's why favelas were set up in the first place, because the powers that be didn't provide any social housing, promised social housing for the poor of Brazil. And now you've got them coming along and flattening these favelas to make way for things like the Olympics, things like the World Cup, things like trains being extended and rail routes being extended. And it's all these people that are being victimized. And the problem, again, from the Brazilian public's point of view, is for what? What is the long-term gain? Especially when they look back on the stadiums used last year for the World Cup, and pretty much of the 12 of them, the whole lot of them are now making a loss and causing more social cost on the cities where they were built.
And they're hugely impressive stadiums we saw. So they're just lying unused, and they're losing money, and they're just they're annoying, obviously, the local people around. But that's just an incredible waste.
It's incredible, but it was foreseen. It's not as if this has come as a shock. I mean, you got the stadium, the Mané Garrincha Stadium in Brasilia, which has no tradition of football. The city itself is only 60 years old, and it was built at a cost of $600 million, and there hasn't been a football game played in it in 2015 yet.
Wow.
And I think the if I'm not wrong, the car park there is being used as a bus depot.
That's disgusting, to be honest with you.
To make some money back for the city. So you've got these stories happening in all the cities. Rio might be the exception, even though the Maracanã is losing money. You need the Maracanã. But it was the needlessness of all the other stadiums which really, really gets in the craw of the Brazilian man on the street.
Okay. Listen, Pat, thanks a million for talking to us. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure, as the weeks go by. Appreciate your time, though.
Take care, Hugh. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Pat. Pat Fitzgerald there in Rio. No score in either game in the Champions League. Monaco 0, Juventus 0, and 0-0 between Real and Atletico after 8 minutes gone. Also, Celtic in action against Dundee in the Scottish Premiership. No score to report there. Okay, that's our lot for this evening.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.